In the winter of 1961, Mary Morgan was 23 years old. She had a new job, a new husband, and a privileged life as a member of the Rockefeller family, specifically the daughter of Nelson Rockefeller. But tragedy struck when her twin brother, Michael, disappeared off the remote coast of New Guinea while collecting art for a museum. It was front page news around the world. Mary Morgan has written a book about this experience, and we welcome her this morning to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's a fascinating book. And in addition to this, the tale of your brother going missing and the search to try to find him, you also recount a number of stories about growing up as a twin, which is always, I think, interesting, especially for those of us who are not twins, and to try to understand that experience. But then you also, in the book, write about your grief and kind of the delayed process of dealing with that.
Yeah. And
I'd like to start off by, for folks who are maybe not familiar with the story, because it did happen a few years ago, I'd like to start off with either that story or maybe some recollections from childhood, whichever you'd prefer to begin with.
Well, I think it would probably be helpful to listeners for them to know that I did lose my twin brother, Michael, off the southern coast of New Guinea. And that was the start of the healing process for me. I had to go there. I went there. I didn't have to. I wanted to go there with my father to search for him. And it was an incredibly otherworldly experience, and very, very difficult. And I was pretty numb throughout the whole thing, completely unused to what I had, what was happening to me, and not. I think that so many people, when they lose somebody, they haven't gone there at all to that possibility. And I think for twins, this is even more powerful that happens. And one of the things that I think it was very helpful for me to learn when I started doing research myself to try to heal myself was to find out that twins really grow in relationship from the moment that they are conceived in the womb. And these two little embryos are growing just next to each other, whether they're fraternal or identical, and that the sonogram studies that they have done show that these little embryos or fetuses at that time are really reaching out to each other in intentional connection by the age of 14 weeks. So there is an enormous bond that happens very early before we're even born as twins. And that brings up the issue of identity, because twins, even though they have a clear sense of I, you can see the differences in the sonograms between their personalities even, but they are grown up with the framework of a we. And so when one of them dies, if they haven't had really good, clear experiences of, of themselves as an individual, their identity, sense of self, is in total crisis. And this definitely is an enormous issue in terms of the grieving experience. But what I've found is that twinship actually magnifies and illuminates the issues of deep personal loss in other people also. And like, as a therapist, I've seen mothers who have, or specifically one mother who lost her child. It was her only child. And, I mean, she was devastated. She didn't have any sense of meaning in her life at all anymore. And it was so familiar to me, as a twin, to be able to listen to her. And she had to develop that sense of meaning and know that she was forever a mother, and that role was part of her identity, but that she needed now to find out more about who she was as an individual. So that becomes an integral part of the healing process for many people who have experienced deep personal loss, not only twins.
And there's a wonderful picture in your book that shows you and your brother outside in a playpen sleeper type thing, and you're in there together. And you know, I thought about that and some of the twins that I have known over my life. Families and societies also really reinforce that twin bond, don't they, with what they how they approach twins?
I think that's so true, Milton, and it depends a lot, again, on what happens to the twins as to how they are regarded by their chief caretakers, whether it be their parents or if they're adopted or whatever. But if the parents, let's say, bring them up as really a duo and not as two individuals, I mean, I've literally seen... I've treated twins who, let's say they're girls, right? And their name may be Brenda Linda, Brenda and Linda, but they're called Brenda Linda. They aren't even designated as to who they are. And because these twins were identical, they were difficult to tell apart. Actually, you know, it's interesting, Milt, because when later on they had a blood test taken and they actually were fraternal. They were a particular type of fraternal twins. But they still look so alike that they were brought up as one. And this made the grieving experience for them, this was, you know, just an incredibly difficult thing. And the interesting thing is that in our society today, we're afraid of death and we're afraid of grief. And we don't really make a place, a safe place, and we don't hold each other in that place where we can experience our natural healing process. What I found out is that we have a natural healing process just like we do.
We're speaking with Mary Rockefeller Morgan. She has written a book entitled When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a memoir of losing a twin. If you have a question about grief or the healing process or a comment, give us a call anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or email jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back with your questions right after this short break. This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Mary Rockefeller Morgan. In November 1961, her brother Michael disappeared off the remote coast of New Guinea while collecting art for a museum. And it was headlines around the world, in part because Michael Rockefeller is part of the Rockefeller family, of course, and his father, Nelson Rockefeller. In addition to that, we're talking about how you can heal with that process. Mary Morgan, I wanted to ask a couple of questions about this. Because your family was so well-known and so prominent, and in this process of looking for your brother and the fact that, as we should say, his remains have not been found, and that later he was legally declared deceased, I mean, was this an especially hard process for you as a family to be underneath that microscope, the fame that went along just with the Rockefeller name, and then let alone the fact that there wasn't a clear resolution to your brother's disappearance?
Yeah, that was very difficult, and it was very isolating. And I think that there was the interesting thing was people think that just because if you're well-known, you're somehow set apart and you're different. Well, you're just not. I mean, everybody who loves, you know, is going to lose somebody. That's just the way life works. And you know, I was certainly no different. And feeling set apart made it more isolating for me and more difficult. I can honestly say that. I don't think it helped at all. And the other thing you were mentioning was the fact of not knowing. Because we still, you know, there have been many stories written about how Michael reached the shore and was killed and by indigenous people there and all kinds of really difficult scenarios. And none of the scenarios of how he might have died are good. But there is no proof as to how. There's no conclusive evidence at all as to how he died. And so we are really asked to live with the not knowing. And I think that the big question for me was really how, you know, when I finally, you know, moved through this healing journey of for 27 years it took me. But I really asked myself, how do we move through the journey of deep personal loss to a place of knowing that our loved one is bigger than his or her death? That's huge, and to be able to take in the gift of their whole life and allow it to live on in our hearts. Michael is now in a place in my heart where I feel that he nourishes my other relationships and nourishes new life and is there for me in a way that's hard even to describe, but that his relationship to me belongs to me. And I think there's an enormous misunderstanding that happens in grieving. And it certainly is very, very present among lots of twins. And that is, if we allow ourselves to grieve the person who has died, that we are letting go of that precious relationship to them, and that we are also abandoning them. And that makes people get stuck completely in the death. And the truth is that in grieving, we're acknowledging and letting go the physical connection to that person that is already gone. And that takes time. But in that process, and that happens, Milt, through the grieving. The grieving brings the healing. And what is the grieving? But the grieving is being there for the emotions when they come up inside ourselves, being honest about how we feel and expressing those emotions, making a place to do that in our lives in some form. And the fascinating thing is that people do this in all different ways. Most people cry, but some people don't cry. I mean, I must say, I was so moved by my husband who lost his brother to drowning, which, you know, may have been very similar to how my brother died. And he said the way he healed and became present for his grieving was by running. That's the way, when he ran, he's a long-distance runner, and when he ran, he was able to get into relationship with his feelings and felt he was expressing them through his running. Other people do that in journals. Some people do that in therapy, one-on-one, or in groups. You know, I worked, we may have said about that with the 9/11, the twins who lost their life in the 9/11 disaster.
Yes.
And when they came together as a group, I worked with some of them in private practice and others in a group. And when they were together in a group, I was so touched and moved by how quickly they were able to trust each other and to be able to begin to share their stories, and in sharing their stories to begin the healing journey. And I realized how important healing in connection is, that we have to connect to who we are, our healing, connect to ourselves, to who we are, to what's really happening for ourselves, and to trust that. And I, you know, when the break came, I was talking about what I call the natural healing imperative. And that, what I mean is that when we cut ourselves, we know that we have a physical process that goes on in our body that heals that wound. We've all seen that. But what most of us don't know is that we have psychologically a healing process also that is there for us, and we need to partner with that. And we need to go beyond what our culture allows us, because our culture doesn't ask us to move on with our lives, get up and move on. That doesn't work. We have to bear witness to what has happened and to the loved one that we've lost.
I want to remind folks that we're talking today to Mary Rockefeller Morgan. Her book is called When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a memoir of losing a twin. Her twin brother, Michael, disappeared off the coast of New Guinea in 1961 while collecting art. I wanted to ask you, Mary, about the connection between, surely you must have grieved, obviously, in those early years back in the 1960s, mm-hmm. But initially, I guess it didn't lead to a healing process. How does that transition work? How do you get people to move from just plain grieving to grieving and making some positive changes and growth in their life?
Well, I think that the most important thing is first to trust your feelings. I think that is absolutely key, and to make a place where you can express them, and to know that you have this healing process. I think that is totally key, and that happens in a time frame that's going to be very specific to you. And so that is the first place, is to trust. The second place is to try to move out of isolation and to move into some connection, either to a group or in, you know, to some way in which you can express the emotions that are coming up, so you can bear witness to the life that you have lost through those grieving emotions. And they're going to be all kinds of different emotions. I mean, it isn't just the emotion of loss, but it's the emotion of despair, and it's the emotion of anger. You know, why did this person leave me? I had to go through a whole period where I was so angry at Michael. Why did he go to New Guinea? I knew it wasn't safe for him to go. I had a kind of intuitive feeling that he would die if he went. And it was a premonition. But he was so thrilled with this experience, and my father was so thrilled because they both loved art, and he was going to collect this absolutely marvelous sculpture from this amazing tribe of people, you know, in the southern coast that was so remote. And Michael loved those people, and he loved the art that they had, and wanted to make a collection so that their artistic expression could be placed among the great traditions of art today. And that happened. And that art collection is now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So I am so proud of him. But it was a slow transition to get back to your place. And my therapist, I finally had a kind of nervous breakdown. And I was married, I got married, and I had babies, and I was going to be the ideal mother of the late 50s, early 60s. Actually, I got married in the early 60s, and the world was changing, and there was a social revolution, and I was very interested in civil rights and in being a part of a community and making a gift of myself to learn how to be a teacher and all of that. And it just slowly fell apart. And I could not do it because I was holding all this grief inside. And I went to a therapist. The therapist was wonderful in helping me to listen to who I was. But that was really about being a Rockefeller, you know, and because being a Rockefeller was such a huge thing. Where was little Mary and all of that? Mm. He didn't believe that this issue really had to do with where was Mary as a twin. Where was Mary who had lost her twin? You know, he just thought that wasn't really an issue. So then there I was, repressed again in what it would have been a natural experience of connecting with that grief. He didn't really allow that. He wanted me to move on with this wonderful life I had. So I bought it. I mean, he was the authority. And women's rights were just coming into being in the 70s. And I was then learning more and more about how, you know, I could be somebody in my own right. And it was as I slowly got a sense of my own individuality that I began to be more open to this place of enormous grief in me. And another relationship that I had, Milt, was I got divorced. And I had a love relationship after that. And that relationship ended after 2 years, and it was a mutual ending, but I went into this terrible place of grief, just a terrible place of grief, and I was just, again, very, very unable to function, and It came to me in a flash, sort of like in a waking dream, that it wasn't this person that I was grieving, but it was Michael that I had lost. It wasn't this person I had lost, it was Michael. And I finally then realized that I had to do something about grieving his loss and that I had to accept his death, which until that time I had not been ready to do. And it was that acceptance, I think you were, again, going back to the point you were making, our body-mind needs to accept that the other person has left. The physical connection is gone.
I hadn't thought about this, but in the context of the times and how maybe therapists would approach a problem in the 1960s or 70s versus today, there must be a world of difference. You know, of course, I grew up with men don't cry, men don't express themselves.
Exactly.
And so I never thought about how that must have impacted women back in the day and how they were told to deal with grief.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think women were very much connected within their worlds to who they were supposed to be as a wife and mother. And if you lost your husband or your loved one, you were a widow. And, you know, if you lost a sibling, well, you pretty much were expected to get on with your life. The sibling grief wasn't, you know, even twin grief, unless you were an identical twin, people, you know, as I said, my therapist really said, you're no different than any other of your siblings, and look how they've moved on. And so you need to really, you know, pick yourself up and connect. But we can't connect with life again. We can't find meaning in our lives and new love in our lives if we don't grieve the loss of the person that is gone, and if we don't bear witness to their life, and if we don't allow the relationship that we have had to them to transform so that it can come present for us, not as a physical relationship which is past, but as a psychological relationship that or I don't even know what word you could use for it, but that relationship, you know, remains in our hearts. And I had an amazing thing when I was working as a new therapist after I'd done my healing, and I was up in Harlem working in a home for the homeless. And it was a transitional place, a place which used to be an old SRO, single room occupancy hotel, and it had been turned into a housing for the homeless. And this was had a rehabilitation place of which I was, you know, a therapist in training. And I was with a group of women, all of whom were emotionally disturbed. Or severe alcoholics, whatever had helped precipitate their homelessness. And we worked for a year, and after a year, I said, you know, we need to really do something to celebrate the work that you have all done. And so they began to think about it, and they decided they wanted to go to the Botanical Gardens here in New York City, which is in Brooklyn. And so I went to my supervisor and I said, yes, I would love to do this. And she said, you're just crazy, Mary. What are you doing? She said, you can't take, you know, 8 women who have severe mental illness, even if most of them are pretty good with their meds, their medications, you still can't do that. And so I thought about it and I went home from work and I just could feel Michael in the background. I could just feel him, and I could just see him. He was just there smiling, and I could just feel that he said, Mary, this is a fabulous idea, and you connect with those people in the development of this, you know, outing that they are going to have, and let them show you their strengths, and you can do it. So I went back, and I convinced her, and she said, well, if it falls apart, she said, I'm going to report you, and you'll be in really bad trouble. And I thought that wasn't particularly supportive, but still, these women, you know, it was amazing what they, once they understood that we had to prove to the Columbia University mental health group that we were a part of, that we could do this as a group together and that they were going to be able to use their strengths. It was amazing what they were able to do. And, I mean, it was the sweetest, most beautiful thing. We had one blind girl who was a borderline personality, and she was very angry a lot of the time. And the men at the garden allowed her to touch the plants. It was so amazing. And all of the other people came into relationship to those plants through that girl's experience of touching the plants in a way they never would have. And, I mean, some of them helped with where we were going to the cafeteria and where was the ladies' room, and other ones helped in, because I'm a lousy traveler and I'm really bad with directions, and they were homeless. These people were homeless. So they were great at figuring out how to get places. So we did it together, and Michael was the inspiration and the nourisher of that in my heart.
Mary Rockefeller Morgan holds a master's degree in clinical social work from Columbia University. She conducts bereavement workshops and has been in private practice since 1991. We're taking your calls here on the Jefferson Exchange, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked a little bit about your brother's disappearance. And I'd like to spend our last segment together talking about your current practice today and how you help people who are going through bereavement. We'll be right back with that in just a short break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Mary Rockefeller Morgan, the author of a book entitled When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, A Memoir of Losing a Twin. She is a licensed psychotherapist in New York City and counsels patients and clients who have issues with grief and loss, and especially those who have lost a twin. She lost a twin brother herself back in 1961, her brother Michael. If you would like to call in, if you have any questions or comments you'd like to relate about the grief process, you can reach us at 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Mary Morgan, let's talk a little bit more. We've kind of moved forward, and you began to discuss your work as a psychotherapist. And I was just curious about some of the things that you have learned because of your experience and your academic work and seeing clients that you could relate to people that would be helpful for them as they work through a grieving process.
Yeah, and I think we had mentioned that the first and most important thing of all is to respect your own feelings and to trust them and to know that you have a natural healing process. That if you trust and you express the emotions that come forward, that you are going to be able to heal. I think there's enormous hope in that. It took me 27 years to heal, and the reason is because people didn't understand what was happening to me. They didn't understand, as a twin, the issues of that I had to really deal with in terms of my identity, trying to find who I was now as an individual, as opposed to being framed in the we of the twinship. And they didn't understand that it was going to take a long time for me, and that it was fine for it to take a long time. And that when you love somebody that deeply, that the relationship can't heal unless you take the time. The deeper and the more profound the more interrelated the relationship is, the longer the grieving process is going to take. But when you're doing that, by allowing these emotions and expressing them in some form, what you're really doing is that you are bearing witness to your loved one's life. You are honoring their life by doing this. When we get up and move on and just, you know, it's as if that person's life is blanked out. That is just really not what nature has what nature's giving us and what is natural for us. Our culture is what is unnatural, and we're afraid of grief. And I think that one of the things that I want to talk about is this whole place of misunderstanding in terms of grief. That there is a great misunderstanding with many, many people. And many of us feel if we allow ourselves to grieve the person who has died, we are letting go our precious relationship to them. And that, and especially for twins too, we're abandoning the one we love. And in truth, in grieving, we are acknowledging and letting go the physical connection that is gone. And that in that process, we are honoring and bearing witness to the one who's gone. And that that is actually a transformational process. So that if we know that the grief is not going to... Another thing that happens, Milt, is that some people feel they're going to die. That the grieving is so, you know, that this is so overwhelming that if they allow themselves to open up to what's happened, they're going to die. Well, and that's what I felt. And I talk about that in the book. Actually, one whole half of my body became really ill in many different ways, both physically, you know, aches in my bones and everything, and then the sense that I was going to die and other pains. And I think that that half of my body, that place of connection to Michael, that physical place of connection, that this was psychologically experiencing it physically, if you know what I mean. In other words, my physical body was experiencing the psychological loss, which really felt like half of myself was lost. But that that what is dying, that there is something that's actually dying. We aren't dying. Our whole body isn't dying. We aren't dying. But the place in us that is connected to the physical reality of that other person is dying because that person is, can't be there for us anymore. And that has to be let go. That feels like a death. And that can be very overwhelming and terrifying and can get the person stuck.
In your grieving process, both in the early stages and the late, I was wondering, the memories, the pleasant memories you had of growing up with Michael as a twin, were those always helpful to you, or were they at some point in that grieving process painful to you because he was no longer around?
Well, I wasn't in relationship to those memories. The fascinating thing was that... that's so interesting that you bring that up because I wrote the book first without those memories, Milt. And my editor said a very fascinating thing to me. She said to me, Mary, she said, you know, you're taking these people on this journey, and especially to New Guinea and to all, you know, to what happened to you and the terribly difficult things that happened to you, but you're not... But the person who's reading the book is not able to know who you lost. So you need to really let them know, what is this relationship that you lost? And I said, well, you know, it's been so long, I don't know whether I can do this. She said, put down the memories. I said, I'm not sure I can do it. So I went out to the country. Again, it was, it's always helpful for me to go away and be in a place near nature that helps me. And I just sat there and I began to think about Michael. And the memories started coming, these beautiful memories. Memories that I had, you know, sort of had in the background. Some of them were present all along, but in the denial of his death, I then denied his whole life. And you see, that's the big deal, is that when we accept the death, then the life of that person comes back to us.
We have a question from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Go ahead, Sandy.
Yes, hi. I tuned in late, unfortunately, so perhaps you've already addressed this, but I understand you're talking about your own experience of grieving your twin, but I have, well, it's forgive me, I can't remember the name of the host, but he mentioned, I grew up in that same era of, you know, you just don't feel if you're a man. You just don't feel things. And if you do, you hide them because you don't want people to know that you actually feel it. And pretty soon you get pretty used to, very skilled at hiding things from yourself as well as from showing them to other people. And I found that grieving a relationship that I had high hopes for, that where I was madly in love with the person involved, was extremely difficult for me. Typically, it's been like 10 years in between the ending of such a relationship, which was not what I wanted. I guess I'm looking for just sort of general information or opinion on that, and does your book cover that kind of a grieving process as well?
Yes. What did you say your name was?
Sandy.
Sandy.
Yeah. I mean, I just completely, want to be present for what's happening to you, because I think that not only have you been in the unenviable position of having to hold up your manhood when you're feeling like your life is falling apart, that is so difficult, and I think that's one of the really sad things that is was in an earlier, certainly in the 60s when I was grieving. My mother said, "Don't cry." I don't know if you were on the part of the program where I said that, but we were not allowed to, and men were not allowed to. And I know that my husband lost his brother, and I think I said this before, but I'll say it again. And the way he grieved was that he would run, and in the running process, he was able to get in touch with his feelings. I think that the most important thing is to trust yourself and to trust your feelings and to trust the time it's taking you and to not repress what's really there for you. Because when you repress it and when you deny it, then you don't heal. And what happens is it keeps you from making new relationships, from trusting a new relationship, and from being open to a new relationship. That's very common that happens if you're not able to grieve the one that you have lost. So trust that if you're still in a place where you feel you have not met your feelings, then try to make a safe place where you can do that. Try to either go into a group or to get personal help so that you can and trust where you are and don't let anybody talk you out of it.
Anything else, Sandy, that you...
Well, I totally understand everything you're saying. I understand all that intellectually. The trust issue is huge.
It is.
Really, really huge. And I am working on this with some assistance in hopes of finally being able to lay my last relationship to rest enough that I could actually risk being in another one. But
Sandy, if you read my book, you will see that I took a journey into nature. And it was in that journey that I took by myself in nature that I actually stood up and bore witness out loud to my relationship to Michael, which I had repressed for so long. And I literally bore witness and talked. And I mean, I was in the trees, in nature, in a camp. I had a camp way up in the mountains, in the San Juan Mountains, way off from anybody. I made my own camp, and I stayed there for 4 days. And I literally spoke to Michael. And I spoke through our relationship, and I spoke through the difficult times, the times I was angry, the times I felt abandoned, the times I loved him, what we did together, and all of it I spoke through until I was ready until I became ready inside to let that physical connection go.
That's a great idea. I actually spend time in nature every single day. It never occurred to me to try and do something like that. A wise therapist once, I was just thinking about this recently, I'd forgotten, mentioned that when she went through a divorce, she discovered that she not only had to grieve the loss of her partner, who had chosen not to continue the relationship, but also, more importantly, she felt, was to grieve the loss of the dreams, or all the dreams that the relationship had represented.
Yes.
And
I think that's very
I definitely want to read your book. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you for talking with me.
Thanks for calling, Sandy. We want to mention that you also have a website that folks can reach you at.
Yes, that's www.whengriefcallsforththehealing.com.
And if folks want to get the book, they could also obtain the book there, can't they, at that website?
They can very easily. They just click on the picture of the book, or it'll say there's all kinds of little places that will help you to to buy the book. And also Amazon or, you know, any of those other sites you can buy the book too, and it's on Kindle and any of those e-books.
I wanted to, just in the couple minutes we have left, I wanted to ask a question that's maybe too simplified, but for somebody who's stuck in the grief process, you've already mentioned things like getting some exercise, like running or something. Is there two or three, like, initial baby steps that somebody should take to get them out on the right path and to move through that grieving process?
Yeah, I think that's connecting. I think, again, the first step, trust and respect your feelings. The second step is connection, because we heal in connection. So your first step is you make connection to yourself, then you make connection to other people. Try to find, if you can, through the internet or whatever, other people who are experiencing this, so that you can feel supported in this journey that you need to take. And and then the other, as I feel, I think that the natural healing process, know that the natural healing process exists and that you need to partner with it, but that Milt, is an active process. That means that you need to express your feelings when they come out. You write them down. You do a poem. I just heard on the television of this amazing group of young kids, teenagers, in the New York area that had experienced terrible tragedies in their lives of loss. And these were kids that were growing up in poverty areas. And they were brought together by some wonderful group, and they were encouraged to write their feelings in poetry.
That's
and
great.
Just their own kind of poetry, not fancy poetry, but it was superb in terms of healing.
Our guest today has been Mary Rockefeller Morgan. She is the author of the book, When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a memoir of losing a twin. Mary, thanks so much for being here today.
I enjoyed it very much, Milt. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's exchange. You can find out more information and subjects and even suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. The producer of the Jefferson Exchange is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Milt Radford. Jeffrey Riley will be back tomorrow. We hope you'll join us then, and have a great day.